today's sermon, I have really one point, although it has many sub-points. And the sermon is for adults, for parents, grandparents, for the rest of us. But I hope our young people who are old enough to understand will also listen and think about what I have to give to you today. I'm giving one simple point, and that is that we need to teach our children the fear of God. We need to teach them the fear of God. Now, fear sometimes sounds terrible. We don't want people to fear. I gave a sermon on this subject not terribly long ago on the fear of the eternal or the fear of God. It's really amazing how many times that expression is used in the Bible. Either the fear of the Lord or fear of God or just fear and God in the context of it. So I'm going to give you some tips on teaching children the fear of the eternal. The first point that I have is work on your marriage. Because if we want our children to love God, to fear God in a right way, our example is all important. And if you want to destroy the lives of your children, then don't learn how to get along together. And that has a terrible effect on young people, especially when we say God's way is the best way, this is the way of life that we should live, and then when children who have an antenna for hypocrisy see that mom and dad aren't living the way that they should. You know, I was thinking about this, that I've thought about it for quite some time when it comes to marriages. We sometimes think, well, we just need counseling. We need to get counseling. And I'm all for getting counseling. But I remember an area that I moved into, and there was a couple that had been counseled 23 or 26 times. I can't remember the exact number, but it was in the 20s. And I decided that I'm not going to do that. You know, if people can't figure it out after the first few counselings, counseling's not going to solve the problem because it is the couple that has to solve the problem. And in one sense, the answer is work it out. Work it out. Nobody can do it for you. Only you and your mate can solve the problem. And you have plenty of information in the Bible on how we are to live our lives. And we have books like Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. But you know, the greatest, you know, direction on that is really from the Apostle Paul when he said that the way that a man is validated is when his wife respects him. And the way that a woman is validated is when she feels loved by her husband. And so he tells husbands, love your wives. He tells women to respect their husbands. And we really need to look at that and work it out. Because if you don't work it out, the chance of your children doing well and staying with God and loving God and fearing God is certainly diminished. Let's turn to Philippians, the third chapter. Philippians 3. And we'll begin in verse 17, verses 17 to 19, Philippians 3. Beginning in verse 17, it says, brethren, join in following my example. The Apostle Paul is saying, look, follow my example. Now, in order to say that, he obviously had to set the right example. And note those who so walk as you have us for a pattern. Not only just us, you know, the apostles there, but others. The deacons, the elders, others leading people in the congregation. Follow their example as well. Note them. For many walk of whom I have told you often and now tell you even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ. So when you look at those two verses together, he's saying, follow me and follow others that set the right example, because there are many many who are amongst us who don't set the right example. Now I say amongst us, I'm speaking of the Church of God as a broad general statement there. I'm not necessarily pointing the finger at you or you or somebody else. But you have to wear the shoe if it fits. Because he says there, many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ. So if we don't follow the example and the admonition of the Bible, then we become, without even realizing it, enemies of God. We're working against God. And so, as I said, work it out for the sake of your children. 2 Thessalonians, the 3rd chapter. And we'll begin in verses 7 through 9. 2 Thessalonians 3:7. For you yourself know how you ought to follow us, for we were not disorderly among you. In other words, the apostle is saying that, look, we weren't disorderly among you. We walked as we should walk, appropriately, within the guidance and the direction of Jesus Christ. Doesn't say it in those words, but that's what he's talking about there. Nor did we eat anyone's bread free of charge, but worked with labor and toil night and day, though he might not be a burden to any of you. So he is using his example and that of the others who traveled with him, that they worked. Because what he's getting to here is those in the congregation that were there in Thessalonica who did not work. He said, not because we do not have authority. We could have told you that you do this. We had the authority not to have to work. But he says, but to make ourselves an example of how you should follow us. And then he goes on to say, for even when we were with you, we commanded you this, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. So that's the context of it. But the point that I'm trying to make from this, and the principle to draw from here, is that the apostle set the example, not perfectly, but in this particular case, they set the example, the right example, of working to show for those who are not working that they needed to work. And 1 Timothy 4, and in verse 12, he advises this young evangelist, Timothy. He says, let no one despise your youth. So he was young. He might have even looked younger than he was. Some people look older at a particular age. I know I always looked very young when I was young, and that becomes helpful as you get older. But when you're young, you want to look older. You want to command more respect in that way. It says, let no one despise your youth, but be an example to the brethren in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity. Now, those are things that all of us should be developing. Love, being the right spirit, and faith, and purity. All those things we should be developing, all those traits. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that we need to be examples to our children when it comes to fearing God, loving God, respecting God, obedience to God. Because hypocrisy is your greatest enemy when it comes to training your children. I guess we could say example is greatest trait or wonderful trait, but hypocrisy is one of the fastest ways to turn children off. They have an antenna for it, even though they themselves are hypocrites. Sorry, young people, but you know that you act different when certain people are around than you do when they're not around. That's hypocrisy when you think about it. But you have an antenna because of human nature. We sometimes look for excuses not to do certain things. And if we can see hypocrisy in those who are older than us, it gives us an excuse to say, well, I don't believe in all that stuff. Children must see in you that you yourselves fear God if they're going to fear God. Now, the next point is that we must actively teach our children the fear of the eternal. And here are some ways that you can do that. Number one, teach them to fear or to respect you. This starts at a very early age. I remember a man, I believe it was in a sermonette. It was up in Michigan, and he had kind of a rough upbringing, as most people did in that part of Michigan in certain ways. And he said that we weren't reared, we weren't raised, we just growed up. And, you know, that's not the way that we should train our children, and you know that, and I know that. We shouldn't just let them grow up, to use his terminology. Proverbs 22 and verse 6 is one of the most famous verses when it comes to child rearing. And of course, we're not just talking to parents here, because all of us are adults. We become like aunts and uncles to some of the younger ones. We become grandparents to them, maybe our grandparents to them. But we all have the opportunity to be an influence to them in showing them attention and talking with them and giving them little gifts and different things like some of you do. We have to be careful about that, but that's, you know, sometimes people give out a lot of candy and maybe mom and dad don't want that, but I guess others can spoil your children's. Grandparents do, so why not others? But I'm not promoting this. I'm just saying it does happen. And we can show young people that we recognize them, that we care for them. So this is for all of us in that sense. But to teach them to respect you. In Proverbs 22 and verse 6, it tells us, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. Now, I've heard people say that this really is saying, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he'll come back. So many words. That's not what the scripture says. It's more like, even when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, in the Proverbs, they're not absolute guarantees in every case that if we do these things, because in this particular case, children do have a mind of their own, and they're going to have to make decisions themselves, and God is going to hold them accountable for what they do. But the fact is, if we train up a child in the way he should go, he's much more likely to follow that way even into old age. Now, down in verse 15, it says, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of correction will drive it far from him. We've had a lot of different books that have come out over the last century, I suppose even before that, but I have to start talking in centuries, because some of those books go way back into the 40s and 50s and 60s, and that's a long time ago. But I remember some of them that came out. Dr. Spock had a number of books on the subject, and he became the guru of child rearing. And so some people think that they should never spank a child. And I don't particularly like the word rod here, because it really is more like a switch. Because I used to read this and think, boy, a rod, that's like something you club them with, like a baseball bat or something, maybe a broomstick. No, that's not what it's talking about. It's talking about a switch that will put a little sting there. And it says here that the rod of correction will drive it, that is foolishness, that's bound in his heart, far from him. And I look back, and I'm thankful that my parents, especially my father, I think he used his hand, maybe a little paddle. My mother might have used a time or two, but they used that. And I look back and realize that, boy, I deserved a whole lot more than I got. And if I was ever corrected unjustly, it was only to make up for the 100 times that I should have been corrected. No, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. That's what God says. But people disagree with God sometimes. And we have to ask ourselves, what else do we disagree with when God says something, if we're going to take that approach toward things? Notice Proverbs 29 and verse 15. 29:15. And here it says, the rod and rebuke give wisdom. So if we want our children to have wisdom, they need to come to respect us as adults. Some children have no respect for their parents or adults. I've seen little children kicking mom or dad, and they tell them not to do that. Well, unless a problem. And people say, well, they're doing that because we spanked them. No, they're doing that because they can get away with it. And I remember, I've told this story before, but I was visiting with a young lady, my wife and I were, and she said, I know this is wrong, but I hate my son. He was about, I don't know, what was it, three? He wasn't very old. Maybe he was two. And he was a total out of control brat. And as we were sitting there, he was playing and she told him to do something and he didn't do it. And I said, well, you know, the problem here is that he doesn't really believe that you mean it. And you need to spank him. And when you tell him to do something and he doesn't do it, he needs to know that when mom speaks, he's supposed to do it. And I said, like, right now. And so she went over and she spanked him and he screamed and hollered and, I don't know, said some things to her that he shouldn't. And I said, you know, the problem is that you didn't get to the heart of the matter. You need to pull that diaper down or those pants down, and he needs to feel it. And she did it. It's shocking. Sometimes people actually listen to you. And she did it, and there was a different cry. It was a hurt cry. And the next thing you know, he was up in her arms, you know, wanting to make up, so to speak. And you know, within a matter of just a very few months, he turned into one of the nicest, most respectful little fellows you could ever imagine. I know he had his moments, and he tested her, no doubt, from time to time, but the change was so dramatic. And you know what my wife and I have noticed over the years? We've talked about this and we've seen it. An undisciplined child is an unhappy child. Just watch sometimes. An undisciplined child is unhappy. He's crying, he's moody, always doing certain things. Now, please understand, some have taken physical discipline to an extreme. And that is not the answer to every problem that exists. There are different ways that we get through to our children. Sometimes it's okay, time out. I'm not a fan of time out, but sometimes that's what it takes. There are certain things that we need to do, but we need to teach our children, first of all, to respect us, because they don't fear us. If they don't respect us, do we really think they're going to fear and respect God and love God? I dare say they will not. Over in Hebrews, the 12th chapter, it explains a little bit about discipline and correction, and we're familiar with this. He's talking here about adults, but does this not apply to our children as well? He says in verse 8, Hebrews 12, verse 8, but if you are without chastising or chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed, our fathers, our physical fathers, indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them. They did the best job they knew how. Some do better than others, no doubt, for a variety of reasons. It says, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now, no chastening, verse 11, seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Notice, painful. Chastening is painful. Nevertheless, afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. So there's something that good comes from chastening, and God chastens us. He allows sicknesses, he allows injuries, he allows all kinds of things to happen to us to teach us important lessons. You know, even at the end of life, this is very interesting because up in Canada now, they have something called MAID, Medical Assistance in Dying. I like to leave out the I, which is a little bit more accurate. But I think you've seen this in the lives of some people, that even as they get toward the end of life, there's a reflection, there's an understanding that begins to come to them. There's a change that takes place that is positive. God allows us to go through suffering sometimes because there's something we need to learn. We don't always know what it is. And sometimes it's not for our benefit. It may be for someone else's benefit, that they can learn patience, that they can learn love. You know, when we bring children into the world, it's not always pleasant. When they throw up, when they're, you know, doing all kinds of things, and we have to clean up after them, well, what about taking care of mom and dad when they need us? There are lessons that we learn from it. But it's getting to the place now where, it's just growing exponentially just in my life. I don't like it. I'll just end it. So tell the doctor and sign a couple of papers and they'll put me to sleep. Well, that's not God's plan. God knows that correction, he knows that just the life process teaches us lessons that are very important. And once you start down that path, it started with abortion, and now it's putting people to sleep who want to go to sleep. And then I think there's an individual there that I know that died recently. And if it weren't for members of the church being, or a member having power of attorney, the state would have power of attorney. And what kind of a decision do you think the state would make concerning that person when he or she is not able to make the decision for him or herself? Now, we're going down a road, or they're going down a road of just murdering people, literally. And it's growing, and it will only grow. So teach our children to have fear or respect for you, that when you say something, they understand they need to do it. Another point is teach them about God's existence. Over in Psalm 40, and we'll read verse 5, Psalm 40, and verse 5 it says, "Many, O Lord my God, are your wonderful works which you have done, and your thoughts toward us cannot be recounted to you in order. If I would declare and speak of them, they are more than can be numbered." Now, oftentimes when the Psalms talk about the works of God, it's talking about the things that he has done for us, such as opening the Red Sea, for those individuals, Israelites of old. But we certainly need to look at all of God's creation. There are other psalms that talk about how he has created the sun, the moon, the stars, and all the host of heaven, and the animals, and all that sort of thing. Teach our children about God's existence. I think it's really wonderful that God has allowed mankind to be able to see things and do things today that for most of man's history people could not do. It's only since the time of motion photography, or even still photography, that we can see some of the wonderful creatures that God has made. The average person had no idea how many creatures God had on this earth. They probably had no idea that there were kangaroos and various other marsupials and creatures in Australia. If you didn't live in Australia, which most people had never been there. And unless people had gone there and come back, and that was really only in the last few hundred years. I don't know exactly the time frame, but the last 200-300 years, they had no idea that all those creatures existed. Not only the animals that we think of, but the birds. Birds in Australia are different from birds here. I know when we went there for the first time, my wife and I were just enamored by the beauty of the birds and the unusual birds. And we look at a bluebird or a regular blue jay as kind of a nuisance. Or if you live out in Western Canada, a magpie is just a nuisance bird. But they are beautiful creatures. And I would imagine that someone coming from Australia who's never seen a magpie or a Carolina bluebird or a cardinal or a robin, they're probably just as much enamored by it as we are with what they have. But now with all the inventions we have, we not only have pictures of all these animals, but we can turn on television or turn on the internet, and we can actually see birds and creatures doing all kinds of things. One that my wife and I like to show people sometimes, if you look it up, I forget it, you have to look up Parrot That Sings Opera. It has this woman singing this beautiful opera. You know, and she sings a certain portion of it, and then says the opera singer, and here is a parrot. I think it's a parrot. I don't know. It's one of those birds. And it's doing the same thing. It has note for note. Now, it's not as pretty, but it has up and down and everything like that. It's amazing what it can do. And we call them bird brains, or individuals' bird brains if they... Well, you know, when you look at these things, God has made thousands, millions of creatures, little insects sometimes that are fascinating. I think sometimes people are so behind their computers talking to somebody else and doing something that they never really see the world that's out here, the creation that is here. You know, sometimes we sit, as I'm sure that some of you do, on our porch. We have nice screened-in porch to keep mosquitoes, which there aren't that many, but there are some, away, and we can look out there, and my wife put the hummingbird feeder out there, and we were so excited because we've got a hummingbird or two coming to it already. And to think that this one that we saw this morning, is even among hummingbirds, there are different sizes. And this one's pretty small, and we're thinking, well, you know, it's probably a female, but we think maybe it was, you know, a juvenile. Maybe it was hatched down in South America where it came from, or Central America. And you know, they fly across, some of them, they fly along the coastline, but others fly directly across the Gulf. Gulf of whatever we want to call it today. America? Mexico? Depends on where you are. But they fly across that Gulf, some 500 miles. And you look at that little bird, how can they contain that much energy? And when you see how much energy they need, because they're always drinking, you know, sugar, straight sugar, so to speak, sugar water. And you're not supposed to give them honey because that's not good for them. They'll kill them, I guess. But they like that white sugar. So I guess the white sugar isn't all bad. But anyway, they migrate down there. And we were thinking, well, maybe they hatch down there. We know that they have nests up here and they hatch. Maybe they do it. I don't know. This is a small one. But they're different. They have different personalities. All animals have different personalities. We just aren't able to always see everything they do, but everyone is different, just like all our fingerprints are different, all our voices are different, all our facial expressions. That's why they can use recognition. There's incredible diversity because God created us to be that way. And when we take them out and they see God's creation, they're much more likely to appreciate God. Because when they get into school, they're going to be told that God didn't create them. That's just a natural thing. That everything just evolved. And it always looks so logical at the time when you don't think it through. Well, this horse was starving, so only the ones that could reach a little bit higher and, you know, after generations, they turned into giraffes or something. Doesn't work that way. Just simply does not work that way. Our horses that are, or animals that are a little bit taller, are they able to get fruit from a tree? Yes, there's a certain amount of microevolution that takes place, but macroevolution, changes from one species to another, just simply doesn't happen. But they have these just-so stories. Take Mr. Smith's booklet on creation or evolution, which, or evolution, creation, which is it? We've got that booklet on the subject. But there's also wonderful information out there. Intelligent design movement just funnels all kinds of information out there that shows the impossibility. I think I've told you before that you have a, and this is not for a five-year-old. Well, you can tell them. I don't know if they'll understand it. If it was my Uncle George, he might have understood it because he's pretty bright at five. But kind of dumb in other ways because he was an atheist. But he, part of the reason he was an atheist is because he saw the hypocrisy in Christianity. That's not part of it. That was what started him down that path. But we have a protein in us that allows our muscles to lengthen and come together. Just one of a million proteins, perhaps, that make up the human body is called chitin. And it has something like, and the figures vary, but this is a mid-sized figure from 28 to, say, 35 or 33 or 35,000 amino acids, which mean a sentence, if you took 20 letters and you strung them together in a meaningful way, you'd have to come up with some 30,000 of them to make chitin. The chance of that happening is a 1 followed by 42,000 zeros. And every time you add a zero, you multiply the previous figure 10 times over. And pretty soon it's just absolutely insane to think that these things could just happen by chance. But a five-year-old doesn't need to know that. A five-year-old needs to look at the animals and the creatures and all that God has done and see the marvels and the wonders, and looking at a butterfly and how wonderfully made it is. And they're so delicate. Have you ever seen a bird try to catch a moth or a butterfly? That's why they dart around. They kind of jump around. It's not an easy target. If they were just going along smoothly, they'd be an easy target. But they kind of jump up and down and move around. There's so much we can teach our children about the greatness of God. So teach your children about God's existence. Show that there is a God. There is a creator. And we don't have to apologize for that. The evidence is on our side if we bring it out. You can read Romans, the first chapter, where he talks about those who should know better, but they suppress the truth. Truth about God, about the Godhead. Another thing we can do is teach them diligently about God's law and how it has transformed your life. How it's transformed your life. Before I get that, let me go back to the previous point, because I wanted to point out this. In my notes, I said, point out the birds and the wonders of nature. And I changed that, the wonders of God. You know, Satan is a master of deception. And so we speak of nature. We don't say God, we say nature. I say we, the world. Now, nature just means the natural. That comes from the same origin as natural. That which is natural. But what is natural? If you stop to think about it, even that word is deceptive. I'm not saying you should never use nature or natural. But we ought to think about what we're saying when we say those things. Because it isn't natural. It is supernatural. Every creature is designed. It didn't just happen. It isn't just, quote, natural. It is something that is created by God. So point out the wonders, not of nature, but of God. Now on to the next point. Teach them diligently about God's law and how it has transformed your life. Now, if your life hasn't been transformed, there's a problem here. But if you can look and see how God has guided your life, blessed you in your life, and we can share those things with our children, they're much more likely to have that fear, that respect of God himself. You know, when God blesses you, for example, in tithing, I know that God has certainly blessed me for tithing, and I could give any number of examples, and I know that there have been others that have been much more dramatic and just absolutely stunning the way he's blessed other people. And sometimes we struggle. We don't have everything easy. Just because we tithe doesn't mean that life suddenly gets easy. There are a lot of things that go into it. But when God blesses you in some way, share that with your children. When you know someone who has been supernaturally healed, I don't mean just got better, but supernaturally healed, and we have those instances, share that with our children. I remember one lady, she's still around, another, an elder's wife, that has a log of all the miracles over the years, over the last, I don't know, 50 years or so, that she has seen. We're not talking just about something that you know, you get sick, you get anointed, a week later you're better. We're talking about where something is cut short absolutely. You know, I often talk about the fact that I really do believe that God healed me of rheumatoid arthritis. I can do things right now that I couldn't do some years ago. And I was anointed, actually standing up in a hall where people could walk by, kind of in a little alcove off. And God didn't heal me immediately, but he did heal me over a period of time. And I think when I went to the doctor and he said, took x-rays and he said that it was amazing how little damage there was with such a high rheumatoid factor. He said that he was amazed by it. And he said, we can do one of two things. I can send you to a rheumatologist or we can just watch it. And I said, we're just going to watch it. I didn't want to start down the path that, you know, the steroids and all of those things. I'm not saying it was wrong if someone goes that way because, you know, I was still functional. But these are things that took place over a period of 20 years. I had the problem at least 10 years. And it's been a dozen years, I guess, since then. I remember the man that we anointed. He was on 5 Oxycontin. And Mr. Goss and I fasted about it, went out there, anointed him, and the next morning, one of the problems that he had, not all of them, but one of them was definitely healed, miraculously. And I didn't say anything to anybody for a while because I thought, well, you know, maybe it's just psychosomatic or something. No, it was for real. Now, why God didn't heal him of the other issues that he had as a result of the same incident, I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. But I do know that God intervened at some point there. And God intervenes according to his will. So talk about how God has transformed your life especially, but that of others that you know. That's not a guarantee that your children are going to stay with the truth, because many people have been supernaturally healed and there's no other explanation for it, and they leave the truth. That has been a sad fact of history in the church. But in Deuteronomy, the sixth chapter, Deuteronomy 6, and beginning in verse 1, it says, "Now this is the commandment, and these are the statutes and judgments which the Eternal your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you are crossing over to possess." Now he had just reiterated the Ten Commandments in chapter 5. And then in verse 2 it says, of chapter 6, it says, "That you may fear the Eternal your God, to keep his statutes and his commandments which I command you, you and your son and your grandson, all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged." Some of the benefits that we have, that our days will be prolonged. "Therefore hear, O Israel, and be careful to observe it, that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly as the Eternal God of your fathers has promised you, a land flowing with milk and honey." So, teach them diligently about God's law. And in this case, he's telling them, as we'll see down in verse 6, or verse 5, he says, "You shall love the Eternal your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children." Tell your children about the laws of God and how God gave them to you, and how God rescued you and brought you through the Red Sea and all that sort of thing. "And shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you sit down, and when you rise up." That's an admonition, that's a command actually from God, that we are to talk about these things with our children. Not just expect them to come to church and by osmosis pick it up. Now if you're a young person, I hope you'll listen to these things. But parents have an obligation to teach their children these things. I don't know how many people over the years I have counseled for baptism, young people, 18, 20 years of age, whatever it might be, and you ask them, "Can you explain a difficult scripture like we had in the sermonette?" And you give them the difficult scripture, and they've sat in church for all those years, and they have no idea. Somehow, something is missing from their education. They should be able to explain Acts, the 10th chapter. 2 Timothy or 1 Timothy, I always get them mixed up, 4th chapter. Can you explain that? Again, I don't know that you can teach a 5-year-old that, but when they're 12 or 15 years of age, you certainly can. Don't just say, "You're on your own," and think that they're going to absorb everything here in church. I remember I've used this example before. The first article I ever wrote for the church had to do with the fact that it's for the youth magazine. But I had a Bible study. This was up in Michigan years and years ago. About 24, 25 teenagers there. And after we had the Bible study, we did a little Bible charades, and one of them was the Valley of Dry Bones, and there wasn't a single one there that knew what the Valley of Dry Bones was all about. And so one of the girls, when she was talking, the parents overheard talking to her sister, who was at Ambassador College at the time. So this girl was probably 16, thereabout. And she said, I know the Valley of the Dolls can't be in the Bible. Well, the Valley of the Dolls was a movie, by the way. I shouldn't throw that out here for all you young ones who don't know. But she didn't know anything about Ezekiel 37, about the Valley of Dry Bones. How in the world could she go to the Feast of Tabernacles every year and not know, and not only she, but all the rest of them that were there? Are we as parents teaching our children? And you know, they may not like the fact that you want to sit down and talk to them about things, and there's a time to do it and a way to do it. And certainly the Sabbath is a wonderful time, but maybe give them something to read and test them on a little bit. We are to teach them diligently to our children. "You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." So in other words, this is actively teaching they can hardly turn around without being taught. Now we have to be careful about that and how we do it. But we must follow God's example and what he tells us to do there. Let's go over to Deuteronomy 31. Deuteronomy 31. I think this is an interesting way that we teach. Moses was coming to the end of his life. He recognized that the children of Israel would go astray at some point in time. They didn't all the days of Joshua and those elders that outlived him. So they didn't just immediately go into apostasy, but they did eventually. And in the 31st chapter, verses 1 and 2, it says, "Then Moses went and spoke these words to all Israel, and he said to them, 'I'm 120 years old today. I can no longer go out and come in. Also, the Eternal has said to me, you shall not cross over this Jordan.'" So, because he made one serious mistake, God wanted everyone to know that you don't do that. Sometimes one mistake can be very costly. I'm sure there were other reasons why God did not intend to bring him across the Jordan, but notice verse 19. He said, "Now therefore, write down this song for yourselves and teach it to the children of Israel. Put it in their mouths that this song may be a witness for me against the children of Israel." So he gave them a song. And we look at that. Well, let's go down to verse 22, first of all. It says, "Therefore Moses wrote this song the same day and taught it to the children of Israel." You know, we learn from the songs that we sing. Music is a powerful tool for good or for evil. And I'm reading a book right now on the plugged-in generation. And a lot of times we as older adults have no idea what our children are listening to. We don't know what those words are, probably because our hearing isn't as good as it once was, and partly because we can't stand to listen to the stuff. But at the same time, what is it that our children are listening to? I don't think they should go around singing all of our hymns all the time. I think that that may not be the thing we want them to do necessarily, although I guess there'd be nothing wrong with that. But I think that we have to be careful what they listen to, because here he's saying, I want them to learn this song because it tells a story. You know, there are songs that tell stories. I think we're all aware of some of those. Cats in the Cradle, an interesting song of how our children grow up just like us. They, you know, we're too busy for them, and then when we finally have time for them, well, they're too busy. And it just goes one generation after another where we just don't have the time for our children. Powerful, powerful song. Another one about the, I can't remember the title of it and the name of it, but he's talking about his father. In fact, there's actually a couple of them out there. There's one that just, boy, if you can listen to it, even the singer has tears coming down his eyes, talking about his, you know, the old man, but he's saying his father and all the things that he taught him. There are songs that teach us powerful lessons, and they do have an impact on us. And every once in a while one comes out, and those are songs that we should be able to promote. So he gave this song. You can read it there in the 32nd chapter. I won't take time for it. But also teach them what the fear of the Lord is. What is the fear of the Lord? In Psalm 111, verse 10, I'll just read it for the sake of time. Psalm 111, verse 10 says, "The fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all those who do his commandments." So if we want a good understanding, not just of the Bible, but of how to live our lives, of how to handle this situation or that situation. It all begins with the fear of the eternal, looking at God. You know, God can give us a whole lot more than the world can in so many ways. Proverbs 8, verse 13. I'll just quote it here. The fear of the eternal is to hate evil. So that is one way that we have the fear of God, is that we hate that which is evil. But we have to know what is good and what is evil. And that's not something that the world understands. They understand some things, but not all things. And we read in Proverbs 9, verse 10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. So when we speak of the fear of God, we're talking about doing certain things or the result of which is to hate evil. It is to strive for knowledge and understanding. And the Proverbs are very powerful on this when we read through them. And we see what God is saying. And so much of the time it talks about the fear of God. Then you will understand the fear of God. And then you'll have wisdom if you keep God's commandments. You can read Proverbs, the second chapter. Well, let's just turn over there, because the next and last point really is Proverbs 2 is teach them the benefits, not just of for your life, but for their life in general. Teach them the benefits of the fear of God. We're not telling them to do something just because we want them to do something, but we want them to benefit from it. He says, my son, if you receive my words and treasure my commands within you, this is verse 1, now verse 2, Proverbs 2, verse 2, so that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. Yes, if you cry out for discernment. Young people, if you're 13, 14, 15, 16, ask God for understanding. But then don't just ask and go away, but read what he has to say for us. The Proverbs are intended to give you understanding, to help you to negotiate this world, to give discernment in difficult situations. But ask for it. Cry out for it. Lift up your voice for understanding. If you seek her as silver and search for her as hidden treasures. Now, you would like gold and silver and pearls and all that sort of thing, but here is something that's far more valuable. And it's free. It's free. Then you will understand the fear of the eternal and find the knowledge of God. If you do this, this is how you gain understanding of what it means to fear God and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk uprightly. He guards the paths of justice and preserves the way of his saints. He preserves our way. And again, saint is not some sainted person. It's just speaking of the servants of God. Then you will understand righteousness and justice, equity, and every good path. You can read the rest of Proverbs 2. Very important stuff that's found there. Let's go over to Deuteronomy, the 30th chapter, a passage of scripture that we have read many, many times. And it's kind of a memorization scripture for many people. Proverbs 30. And I'll begin in verse 15. Proverbs 30, 15 says, see, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. So God is saying there's a way that's going to bring you life and good. And then there's another way of life that brings death and evil. Brings all the bad things that you don't want in life. It says, in that I command you today to love the eternal your God, to walk in his ways and to keep his commandments, his statutes and his judgments. Why? That you may live and multiply. And the Lord your God will bless you in the land which you go to possess. Now it's talking about the children of Israel going into the promised land. But I want young people to think of this. Do you realize that you're going into the promised land as well? That you're crossing over the Red Sea? You see, up to the age of roughly 18, and it varies depending on the person, you're under the authority of your parents. But at some time, you cross over the sea. Now you're on your own. Now, I know that crossing Red Sea leaves Egypt behind, and, you know, the analogy here is not perfect, but there is an analogy here that when you leave home, now you're on your own. Now you have to do things differently. You've left behind the safety and the care of mom and dad who keep you out of trouble, even though sometimes you get upset at them because you think you should be able to do something that they know better than, because they've been your age. You haven't been theirs, but they've been your age, so they understand. But now you go out on your own. And this is especially for you when you think about it. And he says here, but if you turn your heart, if your heart turns away from, so that you do not hear and are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them. Now you might say, well, you mean worship other gods? Well, the gods of pornography, the gods of all kinds of things that are out there, the way of life that the world offers to us, all those things in school that they offer your friends out there, or even sometimes in the church. There are ways that are not God's ways, and those are false gods, because you think they're going to bring happiness to you, but all they bring is sorrow and heartache. Not necessarily right now, but down the road. The world says you don't have to get married to sleep together. That's what the world teaches. That's a false god. That's an idea that is going to bring all kinds of heartache and suffering. Oh, it might be fun for a time, but there's a penalty. And true fun is going to be fun tomorrow and always, not just for the moment. And so he says in verse 18, I announce to you today that you shall surely perish. You shall not prolong your days in the land which you cross over the Jordan to go in and possess. So when you go out on your own, you may not live that long. Or it may just be a very tough existence. Many people go out on their own, they come back, scarred up, damaged in many different ways, mentally, spiritually, physically. So verse 19, what we often read, I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life. That's what your parents want for you. That's what every parent wants for you. Choose life, that both you and your descendants may live, that you may love the eternal your God, that you may obey his voice, and that you may cling to him, for he is your life and the length of your days, and that you may dwell in the land which the Eternal swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them. We're drawing principles from this. I have a particular commentary at home that is not as popular for some. It's not the traditional commentary. It's by Dennis Prager. It's the Rational Bible, as he calls it, but it's a commentary on the book of Exodus, and I've quoted some of this before to you. But I like this one on page 32. It says, if you wait for God to contact you before you lead a God-centered life, you will almost surely never lead a life with God in it. If you just wait for God to come to you, you know, I understand God can call. I understand that. But if you're sitting around waiting for God to come to you on your terms, as he says, you will surely never lead a life with God in it. If you wait for God to contact you before you lead a God-centered life, before you choose that way of life, you will almost surely never lead a life with God in it. And I love this one on page 36. He says, you can be an agnostic intellectually. Agnostic means, well, I just don't know. And that's very comfortable for people that sometimes grew up in the church. You can say, well, I just don't know if God exists. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't, or I don't know if this is right. It's very comfortable. It's very easy to take that course of action. And he says, you can do that intellectually. But you cannot live as an agnostic. You live as either a believer or as an atheist. You can try to straddle the fence, but you're either going to live one way or the other. It's not going to work. You can't just tune out, say, well, I don't know, so I'll just, no. When you do that, then you're going to live the life of an atheist. You're going to live a way of life that is not God's way of life. And one more quote from him. This is very important for those who may struggle, or you come from a background that may not have been perfect, or definitely not perfect. He says, biology is not destiny. You can be a child of an evil person and be a good person. So you can't just blame mom and dad for everything. You still have a choice. That's what he's really saying there. There are many benefits. We often refer to Psalm 119, verse 97. Psalm 119, verse 97. This is one of the benefits of fearing God. Of course, Psalm 119 is about obedience to the law of God. It's all about God's laws, his statutes, his judgments. And we have a song about this, but Psalm 119, verse 97, it says, oh, how love I your law. It's my meditation all the day. You, through your commandments, make me wiser than my enemies, for they are ever with me. Now, if we think this is only for older people, notice verse 99, I have more understanding than all my teachers. Now, your teacher probably knows more about biology, let's say, but if he's looking at it from an evolutionary perspective, he's on the wrong foundation. You can know more than your teachers. I remember because God called me at an early age and we had the Plain Truth magazine and I could read articles on, you know, against evolution, I could talk to my biology teacher and ask questions that he could not answer. Well, he tried sometimes. He was even crafty and acted ignorant on one occasion about something that he really knew. But I have more understanding than all my teachers. Again, we have to put that in perspective. Those who are older do know more about a whole lot of things. But when it comes to the things of God, which really is the foundation of everything, the foundation of all knowledge, we can know more than our teachers. For your testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the ancients because I keep your precepts. Verse 104, through your precepts I get understanding. Therefore I hate every false way. Again, that's one of the ways that we define the fear of God. One more Prager quote from page 11. I have given this one before. Talking about the children of Israel at the beginning of the Exodus or before the Exodus started, how they were to throw their children into the river. They were to kill their children and the midwives were to kill all the boy children. And Prager says this about it. He says, people fear those who are more powerful than they are. Therefore, the only way not to fear powerful people is to fear God. Thus, in the instance recorded here, those who feared God saved Hebrew babies, while those who feared Pharaoh helped drown Hebrew babies. So, in reality, it's saying one of the keys to courage is to fear God. When we fear God, our fear of man is less. It's not that we don't have fear, because we still do fear, but that perfect love of God casts out other kinds of fear. In Matthew, the 22nd chapter, the man came to Jesus and said, "Which is the greatest law among commandments?" And I'll just read it here. This is Matthew 22, verses 35 through 38. "Then one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him and saying, 'Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?' And Jesus said to him, 'You shall love the eternal your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the great commandment, and the second is like it.'" Now, I won't read the second one at this point because that's another sermon. But notice he goes on in verse 40, "On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." So today I've addressed the subject of the fear of God, or the fear of the eternal. But is it not simply another way of saying you shall love the eternal your God? How do we separate those two? Are there differences? Perhaps, but in reality, one leads to the other. The fear of God leads to the love of God. So I hope all of us, all of you, will teach your children to love God. And young people, learn to love God for your benefit today and for tomorrow.